The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. My name is Jonathan McRae. Thank you for subscribing, downloading, rating and sharing the podcast. We do appreciate it. I know I say it every week, but I really do mean it. It's lovely to have such a great following. And we love to hear from you. If you'd like to email us, science@newstalk.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We're at @NewstalkScience, and we get to all of those later on in the podcast. Coming up on this week's show, we have a very interesting interview with an Italian professor of geoscience, no less, who is fighting crime with his knowledge of rocks and soil. And believe me, it's a fascinating interview. You won't want to miss it. First, though, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Susan Kelleher from UCD and going through the week's science stories. You're both very welcome, guys. Our first story.
This is the anomaly at 1643. Here is the anomaly at 1658. And here is the anomaly at 1700.
Enough with this
anomaly horseshit. What is this thing?
It's an asteroid, sir.
Has to do with an asteroid chain.
That's right. So this is continuing the amazing space science that has gone on over the last decade, where missions have gone up to asteroids in the solar system in order to do various things. So this one started in 2016, took off about the size of a van. It's a NASA mission. And just this week, it landed on an asteroid that is only about 500 meters wide. The vehicle is called OSIRIS-REx. And it did a sort of a swoop and scoop maneuver on the asteroid, where it very delicately, briefly touched down on the surface. It blasted the surface of this carbonaceous asteroid with nitrogen gas that caused the surface to sort of stir up. And then it scooped some of the material from the surface and took off again. And we have to wait until 2023 when the payload will touch down somewhere in Utah.
Why this asteroid?
That's a very good question. So it's sort of being called the time capsule. These are time capsules for our solar system. So they were formed at the same time as the Earth. However, very little geology has gone on since then. So basically, you're looking at materials that haven't changed much over the 4 or 5 billion years since the solar system began its life. And so we're able to look at rock material from that early part of the solar system. We would be able to understand how the solar system formed, and we'd be able to look for signatures of organic life or organic materials that might be on that asteroid. This is it, as I said, it's continuing a line of missions from ESA, the European Space Agency, and the Japanese Space Agency, who are very, very interested in what's going on in asteroids. So you remember Rosetta a few years ago, yeah. It touched down with the Philae lander, a European Space Agency mission. So they're all kind of working together to learn more and more about these unusual objects in our sky.
Bit of a stretch to think that this tiny sample is going to give us any material that would indicate life, right? You'd want to be very, very lucky.
Yeah, you're not going to find a complex organic molecule on this asteroid, but what you might find are the as more elemental ingredients that you would need to get for that. The Rosetta was looking for water, and it was looking for signatures in the water coming off that asteroid, wondering did water come to the Earth from asteroid impacts. It showed that they didn't, in fact, which was an interesting outcome. We're hoping to get between 60 to 2 kilograms of asteroid dust from this mission. But it's not the only information that we're going to get. As well as bringing back that payload, there are a whole range of scanning tools on the piece of equipment. And it's sending back things like LIDAR, which we talked about on the show, and various other spectroscopy-like images in order to tell about the makeup of the asteroid and, you know, the physics and chemistry that's going on.
With the asteroid being so small, is there any chance this push may move its trajectory?
I was thinking about this because this asteroid may in fact impact the Earth sometime in the mid 21st century. I can't remember what year it is, but I do remember that it's late September. So kids have just gone back to school. COVID will have probably gone by then. And we'd just be getting back to normal. And we could be hit by an asteroid that's a half a kilometer wide. I don't think that the lander touching down and then taking off again would give it sufficient momentum to change course. But it is an interesting tactic for the future. What was that film where your man went up and had to do all the drilling on the asteroid? Armageddon, yeah. So who knows?
Our second story has to do with a new body part being found. Is that a bit of a stretch to say that, Susan?
I mean, that's the question, isn't it? You know, just when you thought you'd kind of found out everything we know about human anatomy, you know, researchers say that they've found something new. I would like to, you know, ask if you could guess where it might be.
It's a new salivary gland, is it?
Okay. Jonathan McRae has also read the story.
So I would hope so.
Out of the bag. Oops. But yeah, if you take your tongue and you put it to the top of your mouth and then you leave it there, but you push it back towards your throat. So just up there, up between, there's a little nook between your throat and your nasal cavity, is your new salivary gland.
We didn't know that was there?
Yeah, so I mean, it's not the exact upper roof of your mouth, but it's in behind it. And of course, we all know about the three known salivary glands. They're behind your ears, under your tongue, and just below your jaw. But this research now suggests that this cluster of cells or a little bit of tissue up there might be enough to be classed as a new gland. And being then the fourth of the salivary glands.
They all do the same thing, Susan? Do they all just make saliva?
Yeah, that's the primary element of salivary glands, is to help you swallow and to keep your moist, you know, to allow you to enjoy food and to sort of, you know, speak fluently, etc. The question I was on my mind was, you know, how did they miss this? And the thing is, the location isn't very accessible, and then they really needed to use very sensitive imaging instruments to actually find it. And it was a bit of coincidence, because the researchers that discovered this are from the Netherlands Cancer Research Institute. And they happened to they understand that salivary glands, they happen to have a protein on them that is also present on prostate glands, believe it or not, and on prostate cells. So they were using an instrument that's usually used to tag these proteins that are on those cells and light them up to show you where prostate cells and are. But the researchers noticed that they got to thinking whether or not they could use this tagging system to light up the salivary glands. So they did that. And when they didn't really expect to see all that much different to what they knew from the textbooks, but not only did the three that we know, these salivary glands, not only did they light up under the imaging instrument, but also this fourth area. And it was really like Christmas, you know, it was as bright and as big and as bright as the other three glands. So that's really made the researchers think this is something that can't be missed. And it's not just a coincidence, or, you know, it's not just a small cluster of cells.
That's mad that there's anything within the human skull that we weren't aware of, given how much we've studied, you know, particularly the biology of the head.
It absolutely is.
Is it, though?
I think it is.
But like, we don't know the function of our brain. Where's our consciousness? Like,
this is a 12-minute bit, Shane. We haven't got time for that.
The interesting thing, I suppose, is, you know, obviously this is an important finding just in terms of how do we class our, you know, the anatomy of our body, but also people who undergo radiotherapy for head and mouth and throat cancers can often, if they have damaged salivary glands, have real difficulty swallowing, and it can make their, you know, their treatment time very uncomfortable. So if when, you know, radiotherapy is directed towards that area, if it can be now avoiding that area, which they hadn't really previously been doing, it might improve
help
patient
them
outcomes.
To form a bolus.
Just to allow them to continue to swallow a little bit more ease.
The bolus is the term for a wet package of food that you swallow. So once you've coated it in saliva and chewed it correctly, the bolus is the food parcel that travels down your gullet. There you go. Two horrific looking faces coming back at me through Skype. They don't like that at all. It was just a term I learned. It stuck with me. Our third story, Shane. It's about a really cool beetle.
Yeah, this is the diabolical ironclad beetle. I'm assuming that the animal in question was not consulted in its naming. And so it's uncrushable, they say. It can be stamped upon, or it can be run over by a car and still be okay. Now, I hope that scientists didn't actually do that to test the robustness of this little guy.
Why not? They're only beetles.
Now, Jonathan, they're found in the USA and Mexico, and they can't fly, so they can't escape danger. And what they have evolved to do is to develop a thick skin, or more correctly, an exoskeleton forewing called the elytra. I think I've said that correctly. And it's impact resistant and crush resistant. So they what they did was they took the carcass of a dead beetle, and they looked at it under a microscope. And they applied mechanical force to it as it was under the microscope. And they were able to identify that it had an incredible architecture in the exoskeleton that allowed it to withstand incredible forces. So it actually brings up the idea that scientists have a different meaning for the words strong and tough, right? So you can think of like a cup, a ceramic cup is very, very strong, but it's not tough. It's going to break catastrophic if you apply the right force to it, where something that's very, very tough can take an awful lot of deformation before it'll eventually break or fail. Mm. And so these little beetles are able to do that because of the architecture of their exoskeleton. So they're able to withstand a huge amount of sustained force before eventually their skeleton would fail. What's interesting is that material scientists are always looking to the biological world for how things are built, to make biomaterials that would go into our bodies or other things that are strong and robust as well. So we can learn from this little beetle.
Yeah, biomimicry, I believe the field is called. Susan, our final story has to do with sea swimming, and it's a good news story.
Yeah, I really like this because, you know, Christmas Day swimming, for example, you know, has become increasingly popular in recent years. Now, I have to say that I've never, on a cozy Christmas morning, been convinced to don a swimsuit and wade into the Irish Sea. But, however, new research now may actually have me convinced. So researchers at the University of Cambridge have found that people who regularly take part in cold water swimming possess a protein which is shown to slow down the onset of dementia. So it's quite early stage, but we know that in dementia, the loss of connections in the brain or these synapses, loss of function of the synapses, is one of the first complications that occurs. And it's believed that the loss of such function is really difficult to undo. But in hibernating animals, such as mice, up to 30% of synaptic function is actually lost when they nestle down for the winter. And then it jolts back to life in the spring when they wake back up. So the researchers tested this in the lab, making ordinary mice hypothermic, which is where you reduce your body temperature to below 35 degrees Celsius, switched off their synapses, and then saw that, you know, they turned back on again when they warmed the mice back up. They also saw that the mice produced a protein called ORBM3, which they believe is involved in the pathway of this switching back on again. However, mice that have Alzheimer's didn't produce this protein. So the big question was, do humans make this protein? But the problem is, it's really difficult to get ethical approval to put humans into this hypoxic condition. Yeah. It's really not safe. So Upstep, a group of sea swimmers who swim in the winter in London, and they heard about this story and they said, look, we get cold all the time, use us as guinea pigs. And so amazingly, 3 years later, the researchers have worked with this group of people, and they've studied their blood after they've come out of the water, and they've all got into hypoxia. So they've all gone to about 34 degrees Celsius. Their body temperature has lowered. And they're able to see that they have increased levels of this protein in their blood. And they believe that this is going to potentially give them positive effects.
I'm a sea swimmer, Susan, although when it gets to winter, I'm less frequent, obviously. And I'm wondering, everything is a cost-benefit analysis. If I am convinced now to swim through the winter, the payoff needs to be good. Is it a 1%, a 2%, a 5%? Or like, am I just not going to get dementia if I swim?
No, I don't think that's fair from this to conclude from this. But what they do think is that if they can know, if they can see in the body that this protein is produced, then if they can create a drug that stimulates the production of this protein, then you can ultimately prevent the onset of dementia. They do, of course, stress that just diving into freezing cold water in the hope that it has a benefit is not a very sensible suggestion. So we would not recommend that, I don't think.
Public safety announcement. Yes. Dr. Susan Kelleher and Dr. Shane Bergen from UCD. Thank you very much. Don't go anywhere. In a few minutes' time, we're going to be speaking to a geoscientist who, well, he has some stories. That's all I'll say. We'll be back in a bit. You're welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us, Future Proof. And if you'd like to contact us, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. You can find us on Twitter at News Talk Science, or you can text us for 30¢ 53106. Now, when we think of archaeology, our minds might be taken back to the long and distant past, a time when dinosaurs ruled the world or when Romans waged war to expand their empire. Moments thought to be lost to the movements of time. But we can, of course, learn about what happened in the recent past, too. In fact, we can use the techniques used by archaeologists to solve even some of the most difficult crimes. Professor Pierre Matteo Barone is a lecturer in the Archaeology and Classics program at the American University of Rome. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Matteo. Would you mind just explaining what exactly geoforensics is? I've been doing this program for 11 years now. I've never heard that term.
Hi, welcome to everybody. Thank you for asking me to come in your program. Well, yes, geoforensics. It's quite interesting kind of word because it's combining forensic, that it's related to law enforcement and crime investigations and whatever, and geo, that means everything related to ground, to soil. Okay, and within geoforensics, we have different kind of fields in which one of these is, in fact, archaeology. Basically, we start from the macro scale till a micro scale. So we're starting from taking picture from of the planet Earth from satellites, okay, trying to understand and to study this kind of picture and to narrowing our crime scene investigation, our law enforcement investigation for focusing in specific area, okay. So after that, we're narrowing a little bit the area using maybe drone images, okay. So images taken in a closer at a closer elevation. Mm-hmm. And then when we know very precisely where we have to start to walk on the ground, we use geophysics. Geophysics, it's another non-destructive technique that can help to understand what is in the subsurface without digging. And all these methods are very, very useful because, again, are non-invasive. So you can actually replicate this kind of investigation several times, okay?
And this sort of suite of tools were originally developed to study archaeological sites and investigate potential dig sites.
Exactly, exactly. We use exactly the same kind of remote sensing kind of investigation, okay, for archaeology, for defining and understanding where is the best place to dig, basically. Because digging is a destructive technique, and you can do just once in during your investigation. So you have to be very, very precise, and you don't have to waste money and time in doing that.
Of course, and contaminating a potential site for murder is probably an analog for contaminating an archaeological dig site by destroying the thing you're trying to look for. So how did you get involved in geoforensics?
Well, my basic education is just traditional archaeology. But then 10, 15 years ago, I was involved in this law enforcement crime scene investigation by the Italian police that asked me to help them in analyzing geophysical, and in particular, ground penetrating radar data that they collect normally during a forensic investigation.
Tell me about this radar, because this is another key tool in geoforensics, right?
Exactly. Geophysics is a big word, let's say. Several kind of tools you can use it. Ground penetrating radar is one of these, and it's particularly important for forensics because it's a real-time kind of method. So it's using electromagnetic waves, exactly in the same way of any kind of radar that you can find at the airport, for example, for detecting the airplane traffic. But the only difference is that the antenna is shielded and oriented just to penetrate the soil. Okay, so the possibility of the of emitting electromagnetic waves in the soil and detecting anomalies is something that you can do it in real time. And in forensics, with the time frame very, very short that you have in forensics is very, very useful.
So what does that look like? Can you take me through one of the cases where you use these techniques? I know you need to be careful about specifics, but how do these techniques help in solving a crime?
Well, every single time that I just use the ground penetrating radar, everybody that don't know anything about the ground penetrating radar say, well, actually, it's look like a stroller or something like that.
Baby stroller.
Baby stroller, yes, right. Absolutely. And the dimension is almost the same. It's just an antenna, actually two antennas in a box with a cart, mounted in a cart. And then you push this kind of cart and you have a sort of a video. It's called DVL, digital video logger, in which you can see the data in real time and you can actually also processing the data after collecting them.
Okay, and in terms of a recent case, can you take us through what you were asked to do and what you found?
For forensic cases, normally they ask me to use GPR for finding illegal burials. So GPR can help you not actually to see the body buried, but to see the cut in the soil. Basically, the filling material and the boundaries or the rectangular boundaries of this of this burial. This is the main and the most important anomaly that you can detect with the GPR. In one of these cases, this guy was killed in north of Rome, and the body was hidden in the countryside of Rome, where we have a lot of volcanic rocks. The volcanic rocks, so big boulders, can create sometimes a cavity in the subsurface. So they searching for this body in an area, but the area was very big. So there was not enough time and enough resources, even human resources, to survey the whole area. So they asked me to just scan the ground, the subsurface with the GPR, and in less than 3 hours, I just scanned the whole area and I obtained the results in real time, and I found actually an anomaly beneath the volcanic layers. And this kind of anomaly, I was not completely sure that was a body. It was an anomaly that in scientific terms is called hyperbolic event. That kind of hyperbolic event could be related to a body in the middle of a sort of void, okay, in a space without any other layers, soil layers. So I just asked them to not to dig because there was a volcanic layer above them, but just to walk around this area and try to find a sort of entrance or whatever in this sort of cave, okay, that was created. So they walk all around and they didn't find anything, any kind of cave, any kind of entrance. And at a certain point, I've noticed that the presence of a lot of trees and bushes, but not naturally in a natural position, okay? And actually, behind that, there was a very small entrance to a cave. So we started to dig over there in an archaeological way, layer by layer. And we remove, of course, every single vegetation kind that can close the area. And then we enter inside and we found the body over there.
Nice.
Of course, I cannot tell to the police that was the body of the missing person, because I cannot actually recognize that person. But after the DNA analysis and all the other recognition and identification analysis, they confirmed that it was the body of the missing person.
I know in Italy, it depends on where you are, but violent crime is not always uncommon. And I'm wondering, being involved in this work, do you ever worry about retribution?
Yeah. Well, there is this risk, of course. I cannot say no. And few times I touched on my skin this kind of situation in which you can find a dog with without a head in front of my car, or
really?
Yes.
Oh my God.
Or you can have people shooting you, not you, but in air, when you are starting to do the survey in a specific area. Or you can listen about people saying, well, but don't worry, don't do the work over there, because there is nothing. I'm sure you, please don't do it in terms of, well,
oh my God.
Do it, because otherwise I can kill you or something like that. I can injure you. So sometimes happen, not always. It's not so frequent, but sometimes happened.
You speak about this as if it's like, sometimes people write letters in and complain. That's some pretty serious stuff.
But if it's Italian background or whatever, but we see this every single time, even to others, or in television or in newspaper or whatever. So I don't know, maybe it's for that we are a little bit happy about that.
You're listening to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. We're speaking with Professor Barone from the American University of Rome about using geophysics and geoforensics to help solve crimes. Matteo, how would that be preserved over time? Because, say, for example, if I'm in the forests and I dig a hole to hide something I've stolen, for example, I disturb a number of layers of that soil, but then I fill it in with presumably the same type of soil. After a while, surely that all becomes the same, or is a hole that we dig in the soil forever tainted?
This is a lesson that we can learn from archaeology and archaeological sites. When you cut the soil and fill the soil, you fill the soil probably with the same kind of, chemically speaking, same kind of soil, but the consistency of that kind of filling is completely different. And the cut remain forever, even for centuries. The second after you finish to fill the burial, till centuries. We know, thanks to archaeology, that we can actually detect with geophysics even post holes coming from protohistorian period. So we are talking about 7, 8, 10 BC, century BC. So
wow. So signposts, essentially, probably in Rome where you are, all the signposts pointing to Rome, of course.
Yes. Well, we have also something before Rome.
No, for sure. Can you take us through why a simple walk with dogs doesn't yield the same results? Why? I mean, obviously, there's a scent created by, if it's a cadaver, for example, there's a scent, there's overturned soil. A trained eye surely would be able to see this soil is not the same, or this looks like a grave. Why do you need geophysics experts?
Several times happens that I work together with the dogs, with the cadaver dogs. It's because basically we can double check our anomalies. Sometimes happen that even if you are very skillful in interpreting geophysical data, maybe you cannot give a 100%, you cannot be 100% sure about what you have found and the anomaly that you have found. If you have a well-trained dog, you can use them for comparing and for double check your anomaly. So if you cannot use a second geophysical instrument, because other geophysical instruments are more complicated and more not in real time, they cannot give you in real time results, but you can use a dog, a very well trained cadaver dog that can help you to do that.
I'm trying to think now, in forests that I walk around locally, I would imagine there's lots of churn. Is it in these burial spots? I presume they're remote places, often not with many houses nearby, rural environments a lot of the time. Is a lot of the land not churned anyway for other reasons? Or when we go to a field or a forest, is most of the soil preserved for quite some time? I mean, are these holes and burial sites and damage to the soil layers, is that not everywhere? Do you not get a lot of false positives?
This can happen for within the forensic environment. It happened less than archaeological traditional archaeological sites. The big problem, if you are looking at the forensic site with burials in a forest, are the tree roots. Tree roots can create some false positive or can change the dynamics in the subsurface.
Right.
That's for sure. But in that case, a dog can be helpful, but even the other remote sensing images can help you to delimitating, to narrowing better the area.
What is it like as a scientist joining with police forces using your machine and coming across a burial site? I mean, is that a scary thing? What goes through your mind when you find something that you think this is where somebody's been buried?
Well, of course, the mental approach to doing this job is quite delicate. You have to be strong enough to understand that you are working for giving justice in some way. So even if it's very terrible to think that somebody is buried over there and maybe was killed yesterday or a week ago, if this is scaring me, of course, it's more powerful the idea that you can help for finding the truth and the justice.
I don't want to get too gory here, and just for listeners, we're going to talk about some detail here, just FYI. But what about the cadavers themselves? What do we know about the decomposition and how that affects the soil? Is there ways of studying that? Or if you use your machine, would you be able to see changes because of, I don't know, decomposition or something like that?
Yeah, well, the decomposition can help a lot the detection with the GPR, because what GPR is detecting is the physical and chemical differences inside the soil, so the characteristic of the soil. So when you have a soil mixed with the liquids of decomposition, the chemistry is changing, and the answer of my machine of the electromagnetic waves to the GPR to this kind of soil, it's completely different. Sometimes happen that I can actually understand a sort of relative chronology of the body and the burial and the creation of the burial, because I can see the movement of this liquids from the body, probably in other direction depending on the slopes of the area and whatever. So it is possible actually to understand from how much time you have that kind of burial depending on this liquids of the contamination.
What about the different environments in which a body may be found? You know, in Italy, you could have a very dry environment, or you could have a very moist environment. Does that affect your ability to find those signatures in the soil that may be hiding a cadaver?
Of course, GPR is not a magic wand. So it's you cannot actually find everything in every single conditions. There are some elements that can actually attenuate the penetration of the signal. And one of these is the level of humidity. For example, if you collect GPR data the day after a heavy rain, your penetration of the signal is very, very poor, no more than 10, 15 centimeters. So the soil mixed with liquid water, that is the nightmare, let's say, for version of the signal. So that could be a problem.
I know you can't go into details, Matteo, but how many cases have you been involved in, and did your techniques actually provide important results for the police?
Well, as I told you, because we have different kind of tools within the under the umbrella of geoforensics, I can be involved sometimes with a GPR, sometimes just with the satellite images and so on. So basically every year I can be involved for at least one or two cases every month, let's say. So
wow, that's a lot, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Are you sometimes asked then to testify in court? It's probably an unusual thing for an archaeologist to find themselves doing, witnessing in a murder trial, for example.
Yeah, sometimes happen that instead of just giving a sort of report of your consultancies, you may be asked to come in court and testify what you did and why you did in that way.
And what's that like?
Well, the problem, well, it's not real a problem, but the main issue, the main aspect that you have to take into account is the ability to explain in simple words something that it's very, very peculiar, very, very scientific. And when I said simple words, I don't want to say that you have to simplify the scientific technique, but you have to explain for children, like for if you have in front of your children the technique without giving your idea or whatever, just telling them scientific facts and the results of your investigation.
Well, it's been fascinating speaking with you, geoforensics expert Professor Matteo Barone from the American University of Rome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I don't know what to say to that. Of course, in the back of my mind as a broadcaster, I'm conscious not to racially stereotype, but speaking to an Italian geophysicist, I did not expect him to detail that it's just part of being an Italian to have people sort of threaten to kill you if you do something dangerous, or to cut the head off an animal and leave it around your car to put you off doing your work. I don't know what you made of that, Aidan, but that was an interesting interview.
Yeah, well, it made me think that it's good that our stereotype is having a few too many beers, because I'd much rather have a few too many beers than have someone cut the head of a dog off and put it on a car.
I mean, I honestly couldn't believe it when he said it. I thought, oh, he's taking the piss out of me because I asked that question, and you know, the word mafia was the unsaid question in the room, because we're talking about, you know, crimes and digging up dead bodies. But wow, that was I did not expect that response. So time to look back at our texts and tweets from last week. We were talking, if you remember, Aidan, about zombies. And while I'm not sure about the scientific merit of that piece, what did you think there was enough science in it for a radio item? I was like, let's just do it because I love zombies.
Yeah, it was very clear that you just loved zombies. And there was
I don't know why I'm fascinated by zombies, but I love zombie films. 28 Days Later for me was just a perfect film from start to finish.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask you that, because I haven't seen up until this week, I had the only zombie movie, believe it or not, I'd ever seen in my entire life was 28 Days Later. And I was wondering, would people who were really into their zombie films consider that a zombie film? Strictly, but I loved it. I thought that was brilliant. But I've never, other than that, I've never had any interest in zombies.
Spectacular, that film. There's another great one. I think it's called. Is it? Let me tell you now. Is it Perfect Dark? Or is that a vampire movie? I can't remember.
I want to leave this bit in.
Perfect. Sure, do fine. I think it's called Perfect Dark. Maybe it's difficult to know. It's set basically in an Alaskan town where there's no light. No, I guess it must be a vampire movie. Yeah, never mind. If you are looking for good zombie films, obviously Day of the Dead we talked about on the program. If you're looking for something for Halloween, 28 Days Later is, if you haven't seen it, unbelievable. Shaun of the Dead, fantastically funny and also quite a good classical story. And then Night of the Living Dead is sort of the beginning of that They're coming to get you,
I watched
Barbara.
That on the back of it.
Did you?
I watched that on the back of the interview. I watched that this week, Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
First time I've ever seen any George A. Romero film. I enjoyed it a lot. It's very, presumably because that's his first one, it is very low budget.
And,
the zombies are like, they're really slow and cumbersome and useless. And they're not scary at all. But I did enjoy the bit that you kind of focused on in the interview was like the sort of leadership struggle is what makes it interesting.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of time
and
you're
that's
like,
that's the core of Romero's
you're all still standing
stuff.
There. Just go for, yeah, yeah just exactly. run away. They're going at you really slowly.
The thing about zombie films is that slow, they need to move slow. And I suppose with 28 Days Later, they had fast moving zombies. And I think the Will Smith one, I Am Legend. Yeah, I think they move quickly in that, and that sort of goes against the classic zombie idea of this just slow, inevitable death that comes. But I used to do a movie show with Gordon Hayden. In my previous life, I was a movie critic, and we used to talk about horror films all the time. And horror films are classically under you know, really low budget, because the things that students loved making the most, they were quick and easy and much easier to do than, you know, hard acting and, you know, sweeping drone shots is just, you know, a little bit of suspension, tension, good dialogue is cheap enough to put together. It was interesting to hear what he had to say about leadership and those sort of qualities. The Walking Dead is obviously a very elongated and dragged out version of that. Margaret texted in saying, just wondering what you thought of the last few seasons of Walking Dead. It's now about four seasons too long. Margaret, I stopped watching once they followed the train tracks to that horrific sort of compound. I found it really just OTT. I think it just went on and on. I might revisit it just for the crack, though, because running thin on TV... although if you haven't watched The Boys, like everyone says, it's fantastic. And someone else says, I think Donald Trump would be a fantastic leader in a zombie apocalypse. He'd be great, really, really wonderful. Ask George A. Romero. He'll tell you nobody kills zombies better than Donald. I think the world needs a Donald Trump apocalyptic zombie movie. I think he should star in it. And I think it would sell billions. I think
and he would star in it.
Yeah, I think he should. And I think it would be amazing.
Even if he wins re-election, he'd probably still do it. Just like on the side. I don't need to worry about this job. I can do this zombie film on the side.
Someone else says, hi, Jonathan. Found your show on the type of decision making in a crisis really interesting. I often wonder, how did the decision go in government buildings the night of the bailout? There's a RTE doc on that, I think, wasn't there? I'm sure it was many decisions over many months that led to the decision, but it was a group decision that night, but not enough other thinkers were brought in who would have seen the impact of the decision. Would loved a bit more chat about how to overcome groupthink in a crisis. Yeah, do you know, you're absolutely right. That was a decision that had huge ramifications for the rest of the country. And it was taken in a very short space of time because things were changing rapidly, if you remember. I wonder what sort of conversations were had there. Did someone start talking and manage to gather people around behind them, you know, in that 12 Angry Men movie with Jim Stewart?
Henry Fonda.
Was it Henry Fonda?
It's Henry Fonda, yeah. It's one of my favorite movies.
Ah, okay. Do you know what? I have this memory of Jimmy Stewart getting everybody to change their minds. It's amazing that it's Henry Fonda. Amazing also that I was a movie critic for 4 years and don't know that.
Yeah.
But then I think I was probably about as good a movie critic as I was a science broadcaster, which is
excellent.
I it would be really good to have recorded that. There should be a black box in rooms like that when decisions are made that affect a country for decades. Don't you think? Wouldn't that be a great thing? Even just to seal it for 20 years, but to have access to what, you know, when Osama bin Laden was executed, what went into that decision when, you know, the decisions to bail out Fannie whatever the name of that weird bank was in America.
Fannie Mae and
Fannie Mae and
Jimmy John Mac.
Fanny Front or whatever it is. Fanny Pack. Whatever the decisions were made to bail out those, like, there should be, all right, press record. No one's going to hear for 20 years, but it's important we know how to behave in that environment. I think I guess Marcus Hallegren would have been very interested to be a fly on the wall in those situations. We also talked about...
Yeah, in principle, they should have that black... Like, why does it even need to be sealed for 20 years? Like, you're supposed to be governing on behalf of the people.
Well, I think...
If all of those things are recorded...
For sure, then, but sometimes you need to make decisions that I suppose the outcome is for the best of the people, but... sometimes their reasoning, people would not feel like they could freely speak. That's a good question. I sort of get the impression that sometimes people have to make decisions that not a lot of people will like and will hate the reasoning behind, but overall probably better than the next worst decision. I don't know. Maybe you're right. Maybe yeah. Transparency is what you need. Maybe all of these decisions should be live on YouTube.
Be good watching.
I would. Essentially, that's what we're doing with NFET at the moment, isn't it? This is a long text in tweets, isn't it, Aidan? We also spoke last week about outrunning a T-Rex. We spoke to Cody Cassidy about the likely speed of a T-Rex given hip to stride size, hip size and bone length to stride size. And we found out that actually T-Rexes don't run that fast, and if you zigzagged, you might get away with it. But we got a text in from someone saying, how did the world create dinosaurs, then wipe them out, only to create small humans? It's like chalk and cheese. Well, I mean, lots of things came out, and then it was just different pressures caused some to survive and some not, and some to adapt and some not. But we all started from soupy gunk, and then lots of different things came out, and obviously... If you could hide under a rock or fly above the molten lava or, you know, scalding earth, then that was obviously an advantage, which is why we still have dinosaurs in the shape of birds. We also had a question about liquid petroleum gas. I'm not sure where this came from. Have you any idea why someone was asking? They said, how about LPG for old petrol cars, cheaper fuel and low emissions?
I have no idea. I looked at the time signature and I was like, maybe it was something in news round.
I don't know.
But no, it was during zombie apocalypse. So maybe they were like, they want to have the right fuel for when they're running away from zombies. I don't know.
Yeah. I know it is possibly an alternative. It is lower emissions than some, than diesel and petrol, lower nitrous oxide emissions, but not sure where the comment came from. And then Patrick has emailed in saying, we are being mind controlled because people don't believe in the fourth dimension. The hybrid cult is controlling the world. Hitler was a Rothschild. Hybrid bastard Bill Clinton is no illegitimate Rockefeller. They want a world government and to create a Hunger Games.
Next week on Future Proof.
You should make a movie, Patrick. I would watch it. That's it from us for this week's Future Proof. I hope you enjoyed the program. And Aidan McKelvey was producing. Thank you, sir. Researching was Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, and Steve Dawn. Stephen McClune was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof wherever you found this podcast. In the meantime, stay curious.